weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I.
And I'm Jeff Frame, professor of climate, meteorology, and atmospheric sciences, also here at the U of I.
Today, we're talking about Hurricane Katrina, to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the storm making landfall in Louisiana and Mississippi on August 29, 2005.
Hurricane Katrina was the costliest hurricane in U.S. history, with damages estimated at $108 billion, and it claimed 1,833 lives, according to the National Weather Service, making it the deadliest U.S. hurricane since 1928.
And then you can see the intense hurricane force winds in the darker shading there moving on inland. So that's going to track right across South Shore, North Shore, Lake Pontchartrain area.
You find on many occasions that we've spoken to people and spoken with people today, their faith is what they're relying on tonight.
The roadways are impassable. The interstates are impassable. We saw block after block, neighborhood after neighborhood, community after community inundated. We saw neighborhoods where you saw just the rooftops.
About 2,000 people are still waiting to be evacuated from the stadium, and that doesn't include the number waiting to be evacuated outside the arena and those on the high rise waiting to be evacuated. So many people.
Jeff, do you remember where you were when Katrina made landfall?
Yes, I was a graduate student studying meteorology at Penn State University at the time. That morning, of all things, I had a dentist appointment, and knowing the storm would be making landfall that morning, I rushed home to watch the TV coverage of the storm. The Weather Channel, CNN, all the news networks were down along the Gulf Coast, providing live coverage. The storm was a Category 5 hurricane the day before. Did weaken to a Category 3 on approach to the Louisiana and Mississippi coasts, but that really didn't matter very much in terms of impacts. As I watched the live coverage, kind of by mid-morning, the storm was pulling away from New Orleans, and it was thought the worst of the storm was over. It looked like they dodged the big bullet that was aimed at them, but most of the reporters were either downtown or in the French Quarter, which are some of the highest elevation areas of that city, with a lot of the other neighborhoods being below sea level and relying on dikes and levees to keep the water out. Meanwhile, the Mississippi coast, which actually received the brunt of the storm, was cut off for a period of days, and there was a lot of fear as to what might have happened there immediately after the storm. It wasn't until that afternoon, or really a day or two later, that the magnitude of the devastation in New Orleans really became apparent.
Yeah, and we'll learn that the worst certainly was not over yet. You said you were in graduate school at the time. What was kind of the feeling among meteorologists as Katrina was coming towards land?
Yeah, the feeling was very serious. The day before it made landfall, it was a Category 5 hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico, one of the strongest storms at the time ever recorded in that body of water. And the day before Katrina made landfall, the National Weather Service in New Orleans issued a very famous and very dire statement. At the time, probably the most strongly worded statement ever issued by the National Weather Service. I don't want to read the whole statement here on air, but I will read a couple of sentences. And remember, this was issued the day before the storm made landfall. "Most of the area will be uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer. Power outages will last for weeks, as most power poles will be down and transformers destroyed. Water shortages will make human suffering incredible by modern standards." It still gives me chills every time I read it.
Catastrophic, overwhelming, greater than our worst fears. Those are just some of the descriptions of the damage Hurricane Katrina has caused along the Gulf Coast. In Mississippi, there are reports that entire towns have been washed away, along with roads, highways, and bridges. Helicopter crews have spent the day on rescue missions.
In New Orleans, relief that the city had dodged the bullet has now turned into dread. There are two breaches in the levees that surround the city, and large areas of New Orleans are underwater.
All day today, refugees from the storm trudged out of their flooded neighborhoods looking for food, water, and higher ground.
They desperately need help in the lower ninth ward. Please help them.
James Ackerson Jr. lives in the lower ninth ward, where a levee break during the storm sent water in his neighborhood rising to the rafters. This morning, his son came by in a boat to rescue his 56-year-old father, where he was sitting on his roof. Ackerson, a carpenter at Charity Hospital, stood in filthy clothes, looking haggard on a grassy median in the Marigny neighborhood.
Yes, there's people on the rooftops, and some people still in their house. We rescued a young lady. She was in the house. She couldn't get in the attic. And I don't know how she survived.
So to learn more about this storm and the impacts that transpired, we're going to talk with Deanna Hentz, a weather expert and professor of climate, meteorology, and atmospheric sciences at the University of Illinois. Welcome, Deanna. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you all for having me.
Deanna, can you tell us a bit about your background in as a meteorologist?
Yeah, certainly. I have been studying storms of various different kinds for a long time, but I actually started in hurricane research. As a graduate student, I was doing work studying how different components of the storm can contribute to intensity changes within hurricanes. And that blossomed into a wide variety of trying to understand the cloud and precipitation processes within storms and how they can contribute to how those storms evolve. In 2005, I was in my very first summer of being a graduate student at the University of Washington, and it turned out that my principal investigator, my PI, my research advisor at the time, had planned this research experiment to study how hurricanes change intensity. And so we were going to be using these flights into hurricanes, both with the hurricane hunters from NOAA and the Air Force, but as well as a research aircraft carrying a research-grade radar. And we're going to collect these observations, and especially radar data within the storms to better understand these internal processes. And our very first storm that we went to after was actually Katrina. We started research flights on August 20th, well, basically after Katrina exited the Everglades and got into the Gulf of Mexico. And my most memorable flight was on August 28th when we were doing our sampling in Katrina and we realized that it had reached maximum intensity.
Were you on the aircraft?
Yes, I was.
Oh my God, wow.
Yes. So as we're flying around, you know, we were getting the radio reports back from the NOAA hurricane hunter that has taken these, you know, central storm observations. And that's when we realized that Katrina had reached Cat 5 while we were in air. And that's when I realized that it's a very interesting moment. I think Jeff can also relate to this in his study of tornadoes, where you know you are witnessing a historic storm. And there's this intellectual, almost just, surge of, oh my gosh, I'm collecting a historic data set in a historic storm. And at the same time, your heart plummets into your stomach when you realize that by this point, it was well known that Katrina was going to hit New Orleans. And you realize that a whole lot of people are going to get hurt. We finished our observations. We were in the hotel rooms next day watching, you know, what was unfolding. And it is probably one of the most heartbreaking things in my memory doing this work.
Absolutely. I've never flown into a hurricane, but I watch them and educate my students about them all the time. And just looking at a satellite picture of a well-developed hurricane, it's so symmetric, the clear round eye. There's a sense of beauty in looking down on that from space. And to feel that emotion, I tell students, that's okay. And there's a sense of awe and wonder that our planet can cook up storms like that. But there's also the sense of dread and foreboding for the people in the way, knowing that this is going to be a very, very bad storm for them. And now hurricanes, they only have eyes, they don't have ears, but I still tell people, don't root for the hurricane.
Yeah, it is really interesting is that our field is really full of people who come into the meteorology, atmospheric sciences, climate sciences for a variety of reasons. But a big one's actually to cope with fear, mm-hmm. because maybe they had a formative experience as a young person where they had a severe weather event dramatically affect them or someone they love, and the desire to want to understand how these things work to help protect people from this happening again, that is a big driver for a lot of people who do this kind of work.
I'm also really curious on the logistics of how you would fly into a Category 5 hurricane and keep people safe on the aircraft. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting because I've done a lot of field experiments over my career, and I've flown into severe thunderstorms, mesoscale convective systems before, and that is significantly worse than flying into a hurricane. And that has a lot to do with the fact that those kinds of thunderstorms have a lot of turbulence. They have a lot of really strong updrafts and downdrafts will really bounce the plane around. Hurricanes are really interesting in that all of the most severe wind is really happening in the horizontal. The up and down motions are comparatively relatively gentle. And so as long as you're going either directly against the wind or directly into or with the wind, you're pretty okay. With one caveat, this was an actually interesting discovery because the research plane that we were flying was the first time that plane had actually flown into hurricanes. And they were actually borrowing a pilot from NOAA, from the Hurricane Hunters, to help, do this mission. But one thing that they discovered was a big difference between their plane and the NOAA Hurricane Hunters is that the NOAA Hurricane Hunters, the front edge of the wing is treated with a special epoxy to prevent one very specific problem, and that is that when you have raindrops traveling at 175 miles an hour or, whatever wind speed that they're going, they become like little bullets and they start to drill holes into the wings.
If you're just joining us, this is Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Maddie Stover, PhD candidate in physics at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. 2025 marks two decades after Katrina, a Category 5 hurricane which devastated the Gulf Coast. We're talking about the storm's impact and hurricanes with Jeff Frame and Deanna Hentz, professors in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences. Deanna actually flew in a plane that directly went into the storm before it made landfall. The storm killed nearly 1,400 people and caused more than $100 billion in damages. Deanna, what causes hurricanes?
That is an excellent question, one that we have been trying to answer for a very long time. The short answer is that you typically have a combination of a few different ingredients. You have water that is very warm, typically over about 28 degrees Celsius, so this would be something in the over 80 degrees Fahrenheit of water. You have an existing disturbance that helps organize thunderstorms into the swirling mass of clouds that we think of as a hurricane. And as the storm can actually use the energy from that warm water to further develop the clouds, and it continues to organize until eventually the individual parts, those individual thunderstorms become, combined into a, I guess you can say, the sum is greater than its parts, so to speak. And then as these storms move, they can continue to develop, change. They can go through many changes in intensity before they either make landfall or they can wander off into colder waters in the middle of the ocean and eventually lose energy.
Jeff, how does the National Hurricane Center issue hurricane forecasts and warnings?
Great question. So to issue any forecast, you have to begin looking at the current observations, what's going on now, to understand what's going on in the future. Like I tell my forecasting students here at the university, right, if you want to start binge watching a show, you can't start on season 2 or season 3 because you're not going to know what's going on. you have to start with season one, even if season one might not be the most exciting part of the show. So that means if you're going to issue a forecast, you can't run at the future and say, okay, well, where's it going to make landfall and how strong might it be? Well, to know and understand what's going on in the future, you have to start in the here and the now, which means starting with observations. And for hurricanes, which before they make landfall will be over the open ocean or Caribbean or Gulf or some large body of water, our observations are a little more limited than what we have here on land. They're generally out of range of our land-based radar systems, meaning that we're relying very heavily on current satellite observations from space. And from those, we can actually even get some pretty good wind speed estimates around the storm. And if a storm is threatening land within a few to several days, like recent Hurricane Erin, it never made landfall, but it did come close enough, they will fly the Hurricane Hunters or reconnaissance aircraft. Those are run by both NOAA and the U.S. Air Force, into the storm. And those provide ground truth observations of what's going on, both at about 10,000 feet in the storm. And they also drop sensors on parachutes down to ground level or down to ocean level to get an idea what the maximum winds and the lowest pressure might be in the storm, as well as the size of the storm. And then once the forecasters have a picture of the storm and what's going on, they look at many different computer forecast models. And if you've seen those, they're called spaghetti plots. Not all those strands of spaghetti are created equal. Some of them are true homemade Italian pasta al dente that you want to test. And some of them are, you know, the undercooked store brand that maybe aren't as good. And so which models are doing best with the storm right now? Which are traditionally best? And we actually have what are called super ensembles or corrected consensus aids that incorporate that into them. And model blends and model trends are also important. High-resolution models that only capture the storm versus, for example, a global model that covers the entire globe, well, that might capture some of the steering currents, but it won't be able to capture some of those inner core processes that Deanna discussed that govern the intensity right around the eye of a hurricane. And so a hurricane watch is issued when hurricane conditions are expected to begin within 48 hours. Now, in 2005, that was only 36. And a hurricane warning is issued when hurricane conditions are expected to begin. That is the first impacts of the storm, not the height of the storm, within 36 hours. And again, for Katrina, that time period was only 24 hours. And it is important that you, if you are on vacation or you know somebody in a hurricane-prone area, that to get the best and official hurricane forecasts, tune to the National Hurricane Center or a reputable media outlet. Be very wary of, you know, Facebook, you know, social media, weather sites out there that might post, oh, here's a model solution 10 days from now that shows a hurricane into Miami. Well, that probably won't happen because we cannot predict the track of these things very accurately 7 or 10 or more days in advance.
So we've talked earlier on the show about how you really need these longer lead times to form a coordinated, organized, calm response and prepare for an incoming natural disaster. Is there any way that we could, are scientists thinking about how to get longer lead times on hurricanes so it's not just 24 or 48 hours?
Yes, we have the hurricane cone from the NHC. You've probably seen it. It's called the cone of uncertainty. That goes out 5 days. Now, in 2005, that only went out 3 days because our five-day forecasts were shown to have no skill. That is no better than playing, say, pin the tail on the donkey as to where the hurricane might make landfall. But with developments and investments in research with NOAA and the National Science Foundation and others, our hurricane forecasts have improved dramatically in the past 20 years, both in terms of track and intensity, how strong will the storm be? Also timing, right? When will the storm get there? If I tell you the storm is coming on a Thursday and instead it makes landfall on a Wednesday, even if I got the position right, that's still not a very useful forecast.
One thing that's really important also to keep in mind is that
when we're thinking about where a storm's going to go versus how strong it's going to be, we're thinking about two pretty different things. In terms of where a storm's going to go, we're largely looking at the large-scale motions of the atmosphere. And so a storm pretty much goes with the winds in the middle level of the troposphere, so that kind of lowest layer of our atmosphere, by and large. And so we've gotten a lot better about forecasting hurricane tracks, exactly because our ability to predict those larger scale motions of the atmosphere has improved dramatically over many years.
Thousands of people still trapped in the submerged city of New Orleans, millions still without power, water, and adequate shelter along the Gulf Coast. President Bush toured the devastation today, 5 hours after Hurricane Katrina struck.
But most of the city was not below sea level, and certainly where people lived was above sea level, and they chose to live there. They chose that site because, one, it was a great point for defending the great French interior from English, the English who the French feared would want to take over their claim, and it was also a great place for serving as a port to export the goods from the interior of what was then France and what is now the United States.
You're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Maddie Stover, and you've been hearing some NPR news clips from after Hurricane Katrina's landfall 20 years ago. We're talking about the storm with Jeff Frame and Deanna Hentz, professors in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
Hurricane Katrina made its first landfall at 6:10 a.m. in southeastern Louisiana, at which point levees did begin to fail around the New Orleans area. But there was a lot of miscommunication, lack of communication during the storm. Drones really weren't invented yet. There wasn't a whole lot of social media. Power was out through the city. Cell phone and landline communications were out. There were reports of flooding, and initially the mayor put that up to a malfunctioning pump in one of the city neighborhoods. And it really wasn't until Tuesday and Wednesday that the media became aware and the nation became aware and the local and national leadership became aware of the disaster unfolding in New Orleans. And it still took a couple days after that to really get communication out of coastal Mississippi.
Just to go back to something you said, there was a mandatory evacuation the day before the hurricane made landfall. What about folks who, you know, maybe don't have access to a car? Were there buses or, you know, transportation options for them?
There were some school buses corralled in New Orleans, but there's, you know, kind of a famous picture of a lot of buses sitting empty. And there are a couple reasons for that. One, some people just don't want to evacuate. They don't want to leave their home, maybe that their family has lived in for generations. Some people, they just don't trust meteorologists, right? Oh, they always say a storm's going to be bad and they don't want to leave. Some people have work or family obligations. Some people were in frail health. And some people didn't have the resources, financial or otherwise, to take a bus to a strange city and sleep in a hotel or a shelter for a few to several days, which ended up turning into be weeks and months for a lot of people. And some people, you know, have cars and were able to evacuate. Some people with cars also chose not to evacuate. But there's a bit of a misnomer there with a mandatory evacuation. Nobody's going to check on you and arrest you if you don't leave. And so it was estimated that over 100,000 residents did stay in the city. Now, we estimate the death toll to be around 1,800 people. Most of those were in New Orleans. So that would be a death rate of 1 to 2%, which is still devastating when you think about weather events or diseases or things like that. Whereas if you compare that with the Mississippi coast, people in normal houses there, if they didn't evacuate and they were in the surge zone, they were facing certain death.
So can you just give us a brief overview of what a levee is? Folks in Illinois might not be as familiar with that.
Right. Levees, well, we can see them here in Illinois. If you go out to the Illinois or the Mississippi rivers, those rivers frequently flood in the spring due to a combination of snowmelt, heavy rains, and still frozen ground that doesn't absorb water as readily. And so to protect the coastline of those rivers from those semi-annual floods, levees were constructed during the 20th century by the Army Corps of Engineers. In response to Hurricane Betsy, which impacted New Orleans in the 1960s, a levee system was proposed for New Orleans. It was supposed to be completed in the 1990s, but it ran well behind schedule and wasn't completed by 2005. Now, why did these levees fail? Well, number one, you have a lot of water. A hurricane brings in a storm surge, and most of that storm surge is due to those strong winds around the hurricane pushing water into the coast. So the sea level, the level of the ocean, actually rises by the amount of that surge, and then the high waves are on top of that.
Deanna, where did the failure and response coordination go wrong?
Well, it was identified after the storm hit that there were several places in which the failures to respond effectively happened. As Jeff mentioned, during the lead up to the storm and during the storm, there was a lot of lack of coordination in getting the information to the public. And there's a lot of confusing messaging about what people should do, where people should go. And then also the buses, for example, didn't go into some of the neighborhoods where they were most needed to pick people up. And so people were left to wade through floodwaters to get to the buses. That then took them to the Superdome. Now, it's important to point out that this was a known issue within the city of New Orleans that in 2004, it was actually identified through an exercise that FEMA and Army Corps of Engineers and other government agencies did as to what would happen if this potential catastrophic outcome occurred. And it was identified that the Superdome would be the place of shelter for residents who were unable to evacuate the most vulnerable parts of the city. The difficulty there, though, was that the Superdome itself was surrounded by floodwaters by the time people started moving towards that direction. And then, of course, as many famous images showed after the fact, the Superdome's capability of keeping up with the huge amount of people that were in the facility and not having access to water, adequate food, sanitation became a huge concern. There were bodies that were left after people passed away when they were sheltering there. It led to this kind of cascading series of horrors that kind of happened to the population that were left to shelter there.
As meteorologists, what do you guys take away from this event? I'll start with you, Deanna.
This storm, as I said, I was a graduate student at the time, was my biggest lesson in one very, unfortunately, real fact. That you can have the best science in the world, but if it doesn't get to the right people in the right way, in a way that it can actually be used, then there's not much benefit that it can provide. And so it's not only that we do the work and fund amazing science, but that we actually translate that science into action. And there's a lot of steps and a lot of coordination to have to go into that. And it's actually what spurred my passion in science communication and risk assessment and science policy, is exactly to try to be a part of improving that translation into effective action.
Yeah. How about you, Jeff?
Yeah. A couple things. No two storms are alike. We always say this now, but don't focus on the wind. Winds, yes, they determine the hurricane category, but they're not the most important aspect. Run from the water, hide from the wind. The area and the population matters. And of course, in terms of reporting in the aftermath, right, in those first couple hours as the storm moved away, you know, New Orleans, they're doing okay. Well, sometimes the first impression isn't always the right one.
We've been talking about 20 years after Hurricane Katrina with Jeff Frame and Deanna Hentz, professors in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you both for sharing your insights.
Thank you for having me.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Maddie Stover.
And I'm Jeff Frame.
Have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141. Or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. Coming up next, we're talking about what to expect this coming hurricane season.